Okay, good morning. I hope you guys are all doing well. As I have on the board, I've got a lot on the board today, and there are some dates and names that I do want you to know as we get ready for the final. So I'm going to do what I can in the next 49 minutes to kind of sum up where we're at in the 20th century and in things. So on Monday, we will have class, but it's completely voluntary on your part. I don't have anything really planned. I'll sum up some things, and we can talk about the final if you want, but it'll really be a study session. So I only want you here if you want to be here. So, and you're not going to offend me if you don't. I understand it's a beautiful day. We all want to be outside. Spring is clearly in the air. My wife and I always joke about it after having been here 18 years. You guys, and I was obviously the same way at 21. It's just that 49, things don't move as quickly. But, you know, I can tell very, very quickly when spring has sprung in Hillsdale. It's not just the blossoms, it's the way you guys act towards each other, which is all, it's all good. There's just an energy there that is part of the natural order of things. And so it's nice to see, but I understand. So we're all getting cranky, and we're all excited, and we have all the energy. We're not sure what to do with. I'm the same way. So anyway, it gets down to the end here. And so Monday, as I said, is totally up to you. If you want to be here, that's great. We can talk. Really kind of do whatever you want and talk a little bit about the meaning of the United States and look at your final. Otherwise, if you'd rather study on your own, that's, again, completely fine with me. So what we're going to do today, if I want to end on a fairly positive note, like I'll say it's emotional at times, not necessarily me, but thinking about the topics we're going to think of. But I want to talk about a few things that happen because I promised you, and I do believe this, I promised you that we'd end on a high note. And if I ended in 2017, I'm not sure we could end on a high note. If I end on 1989, we can end on a high note. So that's part of what I want to do today and think about how it's possible actually to fight some of the stuff we've been talking about. So we've spent a lot of time looking at communism, fascism, not directly, but indirectly, as we've been thinking about ideologies and what they stand for. So I want to just jump to 1946 for a moment, and you can see the date that I have on the board. In 1946, at the end of World War II, so of course the treaties are signed in World War II, and the last battles are in 1945, but it takes a long time to demobilize the military, and we do demobilize the military. Most of the men who've been fighting and most of the women in World War II come home. There's a huge influx of soldiers returning back to the United States. We talked quite a bit about suburbia and things like television that come in with that. But we also see, very importantly, an end to the Great Depression. So when people come back in 1946, they don't come back to hopelessness. In fact, there's a very thriving economy. And so we have to kind of consider in America, well, what does that mean, especially after we've defeated the Nazis, but it becomes clear within a year, if not earlier or sooner after World War II, that our communist allies, who were never officially our allies, I'm sure you guys all know that, we never signed any treaty with the Soviet Union during World War II. It was all really through the relationship that we had with Churchill that it was Stalin, Churchill, FDR, and then when FDR passes away, Truman. So it was always an informal alliance. But once the war is over, we realize that Stalin is just as bad, if not worse, than Hitler. Now, we should have known that all along. The idea that somehow we went into the war with this innocence that the communists were okay is ridiculous. They had been killing people all along, and they had been murdering far more people than the Nazis had. They did it over time, and they didn't do it quite as brutally as the Nazis did, but they still were killing just as many, if not more, people. And it doesn't end with Khrushchev. Stalin's much worse than Khrushchev, but when Stalin passes away in 1953 and Khrushchev takes over as the new Soviet premier, he's a nicer Stalin. But that's not saying much. That's like saying you're not Satan. So, you know, even if you're Beelzebub, you're just right there. And that was the same thing with Khrushchev. So we had very thoroughly wiped away National Socialism. In fact, Hitler did the job for us. He committed suicide in the bunker as he was listening to Wagner. He and his new wife, killed themselves. And there really wasn't much hope for National Socialism after that. But don't ever get the idea that fascism is over.
fascism was still very much alive in Brazil. It was alive in Portugal. It was alive in Spain. It was alive in Argentina. And it was, and in Mexico as well. And there are all kinds of weird hybrids that existed between communism and fascism. They're not that much different as they are really just variations on the line of socialism. And we could get into that. But for now, what I want you to understand is that ultimately what develops at the end of the war is a recognition that the communists who had been our ally are definitely not our ally. And a huge part of this, you guys have to forgive me because I'm going to cuss here in a moment, but I'm just quoting. When Truman met with Stalin after FDR died, Truman was a very different kind of person than FDR. FDR was this guy who had never worked a day in his life. He was old, old Dutch money, old Dutch family going back to the 1600s, as wealthy as you can possibly imagine coming out of the East Coast. Truman was from Kansas City. He was from Independence, Missouri. He grew up in an extremely impoverished family whose mom and dad just worked all the time for him to make a career. He didn't know what kind of career he wanted to be in. He started off being a sartorial artist. That is, he helped with suits, men's suits. He designed them. He fitted them on people. And then he went into law. And once he went into law, he became very involved with the Irish Mafia, which controlled Kansas City. In fact, it controlled Kansas City up to St. Paul, all Irish, into Chicago, down into New Orleans. It was not the Italian mob. It was the Irish mob, different but still brutal. And the man that Truman worked for when he was in the mob was a guy named Pendergast, who controlled, and it's one reason any of you have been to Kansas City, he's the one who designed the plaza downtown. Yeah, the very famous plaza. It's probably the most famous part of Kansas City. It's also the reason every river in Kansas City has a cement bottom. It's because that's what the Irish supplied, the Irish mob. That's how they made their money. And I'll say this about Truman. I'm no fan of the mob, so don't get me wrong. But when Truman was called before a U.S. court as a young man to testify against Pendergast, he refused to. And he just said, look, Pendergast was my friend. I don't care what he did. I will never betray him, no matter what. And that kind of made his reputation. Not because that was a good thing, but because you knew you could trust Truman. He was loyal. Even if he was loyal for the wrong things, he was loyal. And so he had that personality. This was a guy who, and I can't stand his politics overall, but he's also the kind of guy you just don't mess with. He has very, very firm convictions. They're not exactly Socrates' convictions, but they're still convictions, and there's a kind of nobility in his loyalty. So when he meets with Stalin in 1945, and he tells Stalin he doesn't really like him, Stalin is just offended by this. And he says, well, you know, your predecessor, Franklin Roosevelt, never treated me this way. Here's, I'm not going to quote him exactly, but this is what Truman says. Well, if you weren't such a son of a bitch, and if you would actually honor your G-damned agreements, I wouldn't have to treat you like a bitch. So that was, and Stalin, but that was Truman. Truman just was not going to take this. And so this beginning, and it's not Truman's fault, Truman's just being honest, but this is the beginning of what we call the Cold War. Because Truman realizes very quickly, these are not our allies in any way. In fact, they are the enemy. So the policy, and I would strongly disagree with what Truman does here, but you know, I'm not living then, it's a different time, we can look back at hindsight. What he does in recognizing that the Soviets are bad is he issues through a whole series of executive agreements, and then you guys have what's called NCS 68 that creates the National Security Council. These are all directives of Truman. He creates a policy of what's called containment. And what containment is, it's the policy of the United States towards the communists. It's the policy that says where communism is now, that is in 1946 or 1947, that is where it will stay. So we had an informal agreement with the Soviets that they would allow for free elections in all of the areas of the Nazi realm that they had taken over. That was an informal agreement that we had with them. We realized under Truman they would never, ever abide by this. So containment is a response, but it's kind of a half-hearted response
Because what containment says is, all right, we know you're in Poland. You had said you'd make it free. You haven't. We now recognize you're never going to do that, but we're also not going to let you move into West Germany. That becomes the policy. So we kind of, and if you remember, and we didn't talk about this in this class, but I assume you guys all know this from history itself, the whole reason World War II starts is because Poland was divided. The whole war begins over Polish independence, and then it ends with us just saying, yeah, sorry that the Poles are under communism, but we're not going to do anything about it. So containment is a realistic policy. It's not a moral or an honest one. And that becomes our policy. So our policy is wherever communism is at the end of 1946 is where it will remain. We will not roll it back. We will not challenge it. We will just let it stay there. And that will be the world. The world will be divided between those people who side with the United States and Britain and those who side with the Soviet Union. That's the Cold War. So the Cold War is this very tense time. Now, here's the problem. We all know that the United States tries a couple of times to make containment stick, and we fail. In Korea, we fail. In Vietnam, we fail. So we've tried several times when the Soviets advance or the Chinese communists advance, we do try to stop them. We were not successful. And the only times we were successful was when we didn't actually intervene directly, but where, for example, Eisenhower funded anti-communist groups in Latin America, or very effectively, when Ronald Reagan, who's not a containment guy, and that's you can see the dates on there, but when Ronald Reagan funds the Somozans, that is what were called the Contras in Nicaragua, who were mostly indigenous Indians. They were Mosquito Indians, 90% of them were, who had been had their rights denied to them by the communists there. So there were moments where we're able to do it as long as we're not involved. Anytime U.S. troops were involved, we failed. So it was only when we did things covertly, and our CIA had a lot of successes, not very moral ones, but they had successes at times. So here's the problem with this. When we get to 1979 and 1980, the policy of containment is clearly a failure. It has not worked. And as of 1980, and this, I'm drawing on a bit of personal experience here, but I was, I turned 13 in 1980. So seventh grade, my first kind of real political awareness of what's going on. On the eve of the election of Ronald Reagan, Carter, we had, as I mentioned the other day, we had double-digit inflation and we had double-digit unemployment, which according to Keynes's theory, one of the famous economists, this isn't supposed to happen, but it's proof Keynes was wrong. And so we have both of these things happening. Not only that, but the Soviets had moved into over half the world. So where they stood in 1946, we had lost immense ground. They now had Cuba. They had El Salvador. They had Nicaragua. They had taken over Angola and Mozambique. They had taken over Afghanistan. And we'd done nothing, ever, in any place had we helped those people directly. But the most obvious, because we had promised during World War II that we would make sure all of Europe was free, we had, through containment, betrayed. And I say this as strongly as possible. We betrayed these people. We did not just let it happen. We consciously decided to allow them to live under Soviet rule, despite the fact that we had been promised and we had promised this would not happen. All of Eastern Europe. And so 1953, the East Germans revolted. We did absolutely nothing. They called us, help us, do anything. All we want is to throw off the Soviet oppressor. We ignore them. 1956, Hungary goes into open revolt. America, we love you. You promised this in the 1940s. Live up to it. Help us. We do nothing. 1968, the Czechs go into revolt. Once again, same story. We're doing this in the name of America, the Declaration of Independence, natural rights. Help us. We do nothing. And then in 1979, under Carter, exact same thing. Incredible guy, Polish knight by the name of Lech Walesa, comes in and he starts rebelling, once again hoping we'll do something, because we kept telling them and we had told them, oh yeah, we're on your side. We do nothing at all, not a single thing. So in each of these four revolts,
they had gone against our policy of containment because containment had said, all right, the only realistic thing we can do with the Soviet Union is we don't allow them to expand. Well, in a sense, we didn't, because we made sure they didn't expand in Europe. We created NATO. And then in places with Australia and New Zealand, we created CETO, which was the same thing as NATO, but in the South Pacific. So in those places, yes, we protected them. But we never, ever rolled back Eastern Europe like we said we would. And that's critical. So if those people dislike us, which they don't, amazingly enough, but if those people dislike us, they have every reason in the world to do so. We betrayed our obligations to them during the war. Not only that, and I'll just, we had a policy. This is horrific. This is one of those things that it's just, to be an American and know we did this, you kind of want to vomit. And I'm really not exaggerating. We had a policy at the end of World War II called Operation Heel Haul, which said that any person who had been once under Russian rule, even if that was 1921, if they had once been under Russian rule, they had to be repatriated to the Soviet Union. And we did that. We enforced it. We have, you can read descriptions of people in Seattle gathering up these Eastern Europeans, beating them, bludgeoning them, throwing them on ships, and sending them back to the Soviet Union. And none of these people survived. I mean, you can imagine. They go back to the Soviet Union, and I didn't bring this in today, but we have examples of where the Soviets either shot them outright. I mean, we're talking thousands upon thousands of people. They either shot them outright, and we even have examples of Cossacks, of Ukrainians who were sent back, where the Soviets actually tied their hands and feet with barbed wire and then dragged them behind horses to kill them as punishment for trying not to be a good Russian. So this is not pretty at all. And we did a lot of things. And the United States was fully, fully involved with all of this. This didn't come out until 1994. People didn't know about it until the Soviet archives were opened, because we didn't keep records of it in the United States, as you can imagine. But it's really horrible. So I just want you to know there are all these betrayals. Morgan.
Did we do that because we were afraid to have people from the Soviet Union in America?
It's part of it. Was there was a lot of worry about how powerful the Soviets might be and what they might do. Part of it was these guys, a lot of them still had not integrated, and especially in Europe. We didn't do it as much in America. It was more those people like Poles who had escaped into West Germany, they were rounded up and sent back. There were, we know in America they were too, but it was mostly people who were still in Europe. And this is a time period where Soviet tanks are right on the border. So it's not, you know, if you're in West Europe and you're in Western Germany and you're looking at Poland, there are about 100,000 tanks just right there pointed at you. So it wasn't right, but they were scared, and they were very, and we were scared. I mean, we weren't sure what was going to happen. And of course, the Soviets get the atomic bomb in 1947. So you know, for those 2 years between 1945 and 47, nobody could have done anything to us. And we could have easily taken out the Soviet Union if we wanted. And people like General Patton had wanted to, but he was denied gas. Yeah, he was on his way to Moscow, and Eisenhower cut off his gas supply so he wouldn't get too far ahead of everybody. There are a lot of weird politics going on at the time. So we were still the good guys, but we were the good guys who were doing some pretty bad things as well. Not always. Sometimes we did great stuff, but here we were pretty bad about this, and the British too. But yeah, Operation Heel Haul, this is, it's crazy to think about. And it's not something we talk about very often because it's not a happy topic. You know, nobody really wins out of this thing, and a lot of people die. Okay, so anything else on this? Thank you, Morgan. Yes, Katerina.
This might be a bit of a tangent as well, but like, when did the Warsaw Pact come into play, and how did like the Eastern European governments like unify over that? I know,
well,
it's like the Soviet Union totally frustrating.
They're all puppets. Right. Every Warsaw Pact government's a puppet. These are all Soviet puppets that have been put into place. They're not real. I mean, they have real power, but they're not real. And I'll get to that in a little bit. So Warsaw Pact goes in opposite NATO, right? And that's the challenge. That's the Cold War right there, to have NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, against the Warsaw Pact. That's a great question. But they're right there, standing off each other. And it is serious. I hope you guys know. I won't get into this too much, but
when we, you guys look back, and I know because I've seen jokes and things, especially people your age, where you're like, oh, the Cold War, you know, nothing really happened, duck and cover. It wasn't like that. I mean, when it was happening, and me growing up in Kansas, I mean, I was right next to a Titan II missile base. You know, these were very, very, very real threats that the world could have been blown up at, just at any moment. Things were always happening. Soviets shot down a Korean airliner in 1983. It was as close as I remember to us getting very close to launching at them. And there were serious moments, definitely. Didn't happen, obviously, so we can kind of laugh at it. But it was real. And I'm sure, I know people my age, I still, it's only about once a year now, but I still have nuclear war dreams. It's just, nightmare is just there. It's always the same dream. I'm, for some reason, in Topeka, Kansas, and I can't move. I can see the explosion coming, just staring at it. But that's, there's no one my age who doesn't have those. It's just what, and it's no big deal, but it's what we grew up with. It was real. So just, yep, keep that in mind. It wasn't a joke. It was real. I'm glad we can make a joke out of it now, but it definitely was not a joke. Okay, so what turns around? I've mentioned three people on the board, and I'm going to talk about them each because I want to give you some hope, and I want you to realize that there are some really, really good things that happen, no matter how bad it is. Russell Kirk, who we talked about briefly on Wednesday, once argued that there's never been a time in our history when we have a tyrant that we also don't have an anti-tyrant. We just don't always recognize them. Sometimes we miss them. Maybe it's Dorothy Day, who is doing everything possible in a New York soup kitchen. So we don't see her. Yeah, we just know she's off doing these great things, but we see Stalin. We don't see Dorothy Day. And Kirk says, this is, and it's very Augustinian, but it's the notion that every time some kind of demonic influence, and I use that loosely, but every time some kind of bad influence comes into the world, they're also counter goods and people. So I will admit, these are my three heroes as I look. So I'm picking them intentionally, but I hope you see why I'm picking them. So Alexander Solzhenitsyn is the first one I want to start with. Alexander Solzhenitsyn is a Russian. He died just about 9 years ago, 2008, I think. A Russian who had been a communist and had fought on the side of Russia during World War II. Had, however, captured some Germans, and during the capturing of those Germans, had found that these Germans were pretty intellectual, these soldiers he had captured, and he formed a friendship. And so after the war, he started corresponding with these Germans, and that was illegal in the Soviet Union. His wife turned him into the KGB, and the KGB arrests him, throws him in the Siberian gulag, and when he gets there, he is so horrified by what's going on in the gulag. And the gulag, the Soviet prison system, is meant not to kill you, but to demoralize you. One of the things that Solzhenitsyn says immediately is that it is best if you're executed. The worst thing that can happen to you is living through the gulag, because the entire thing is a series of tortures. It's meant, and not just physical tortures, but mental and psychological tortures. The goal is that the Soviets will tell you one day, oh, by the way, you know, here you are stuck in this gulag. We arrested your children, maybe 12-year-old, and we beat them to death. Sorry. And then the next day they'll say, oh, no, we didn't actually kill your children. They're fine. And then the next day, oh, we did kill your wife, though, so your children are homeless. These are the kinds of things that they would tell. And you're stuck in the gulag. And what do you know? You have no idea. You're 1,000 miles away from your kids. And this is the kind of stuff, the mind games, that the Soviet soldiers are playing all of the time. So I'm going to read to you a passage here from the third volume of the Gulag. And I want you to keep this in mind. Solzhenitsyn, he may be the single greatest. I'll exclude for a moment Hayek and a few others, just because I like them so much. But if we exclude some of those people we absolutely love at Hillsdale, I would be willing to say it's possible that Solzhenitsyn was the greatest intellect and mind of the 20th century, especially in terms of not only what he saw, but how he was able to put it down on paper. So he ends up, while he's in the gulag, writing this massive three-volume history of the gulag. Now, just think about the logistics of that for a moment. Anyone in here imagine that every day they hand him a new ream of you know, paper. Good luck, Alex. You know, we're glad you're recording how evil we are. You know, if you include me, could you tell me about that? I'd like to hear. I mean, this is so scraps of toilet paper that he can get, and he could have tiny handwriting. He could get every once in a while a prison order transfer that he could write on. But the volumes are about this big on small font. And he wrote all of that within his years in the Gulag. One of the things he did, he's not Catholic, but this becomes important. One of the things he did, for some reason, the soldiers never took away rosaries. We don't know exactly why. They just, you know, maybe they didn't know what they are because the Eastern Orthodox Church don't use them, but they never took away rosaries. And so people would pass along the ceiling rosaries to Solzhenitsyn. And he would take them, and he had such a profound mind that on each bead of a rosary, he could, in his head, write an entire chapter and have it completely memorized. So just imagine that. He's writing in his head an entire chapter, and then he'd go to the next bead. And the rosaries were different enough. He knew which book he was on. You could hand him a rosary from 10 years ago. He knew exactly what that bead was. That was the kind of memory he had. And you're going to see that here with these three people. They all have this bizarre, almost autistic sense of intelligence, the things that they're able to do. So Solzhenitsyn is able to get this. And so when he's finally smuggled out of the Soviet Union, he writes it all down. But it was everything that he had done when he was in there. At the end of volume one, he writes this, and obviously the opening sentence you can't take seriously or you'd stop reading, but he's trying to create an atmosphere. My gentle reader, I ask you to shut your eyes. Do you hear the thundering of wheels? Those are the cars rolling all on and on. Those are the red cows rolling every minute of every day and every day of every year. And you can hear the water gurgling. Those are the prisoners' barges moving on and on. And those are the motors of the Black Marias. They're roaring everywhere, at every moment. They are arresting someone at some time. They are cramming him somewhere, moving him about. And that hum you hear, those are the overcrowded cells of the transit prisons. And that cry, those are the complaints of those who have been plundered, raped, and beaten to within an inch of their lives. We have reviewed and considered all the methods of delivering prisoners, and we have found that they are all worse. We have examined the transit prisons, but we have not found any that were good. And that last human hope that there might be something better ahead, that when you finally get to the prison, it will be better, that is the most false hope you can imagine. For when you get to the camp, it will be nothing but worse. So that's Solzhenitsyn. You can tell the writing is incredible. And this is what he's trying to get at. He wants us to recognize that no matter how many people die, all the numbers, the 62 million people slaughtered in the Gulag by the Soviets, they're each a unique soul that has been destroyed. It's not the body that matters. I mean, the body does matter, but it's the soul. And that's why he says, if you're going to get arrested, the best thing that can happen to you is to be shot immediately. Because then you die a martyr. You die without ever having the temptation of folding. We know that in torture, everybody gives up at some point. It's just not possible to resist torture forever, even the strongest man. And that really is, and I'll give you an exception here, but that really is the norm that we see. So the other person I want to mention, this guy, Carol Wojtyla, Catholic, is named the Bishop of Krakow in 1958. He had been very famously, he has his PhD in philosophy. He's also a playwright. You guys will know him as John Paul II, if you know his name at all. But he had been the leading college student in the anti-Nazi underground during World War II. And then the moment the Soviets take over, he becomes the leader of the anti-communist underground. He is a philosopher, he is a poet, and he decides that the best thing he can do to fight both of these things is to become a priest. So he becomes a Roman Catholic priest. And for 20 years, from 1958 up until 1978, he's one of the most successful bishops in the Catholic Church because he never succumbs to any of the offers the Soviets make him, the puppet regime in Poland. He is able at every level to fight them. And he does so publicly that the Soviets really don't know what to do with this guy. In fact, they're going to try and kill him here in a little bit. They'll fail, but they're going to try. So they hate this guy. And then in 1978, for the first time in 500 years, he, as a Pole, is named the Pope of the Catholic Church. It had been all Italians up to that. There had not been anybody but an Italian for 500 years. And now they elect this Pole. And there's no... Everybody knows what this means. You've just elected the most anti-communist guy in the world to be the head of the Catholic Church, the largest single church in the world at that point, right? 1.3 billion people, at least in name, being Catholic. So that's an amazing thing. And he gets elected. The Soviets are freaking out about this. I'm going to just read to you briefly. This is a statement, and it's just so goofy. This is a statement that the Soviets send out to their people, telling them to beware. Beware of the Pope. He is our greatest enemy. This is 1979. He's our greatest enemy. Due to his uncommon skills and his great sense of humor. And if you ever go back and look, he was funny. So even when he was elected bishop, he was out on a hike in the Polish mountains, and a helicopter had to come to him and say, "You've just been elected bishop of Krakow. We need you back there." And he said, "No, are you kidding? I've got 3 more days on my hike. When I'm done, I'll go back." That's so really, and that was just, he was hilarious. I mean, absolutely hilarious. Due to his uncommon skills and great sense of humor, he is dangerous. He charms everyone he meets, but especially the journalists. Besides, he always goes for cheap gestures. For example, if you ever watch him when he's walking through a crowd, he'll kiss babies as though he's a presidential candidate. And he loves wearing that goofy Highlanders hat from Scotland. I'm reading directly from a Soviet pamphlet. Right? This is what they're worried about. And of course, in April of 1981, they hire a Bulgarian to shoot him. And he is moving down the street. Bulgarian takes a shot, and the bullet misses his heart by a half millimeter. A half millimeter. Just think about that for a moment. And it's all because at the last second, the Pope turned because he claimed he saw a vision in the crowd. Now, take that for whatever it's worth. But it's pretty amazing that he turned, and that's what saved him. He also went on, by the way, to meet with the guy, to forgive him. The guy has since converted from Islam to Christianity, who shot him. Now, he goes back to Poland in 1979, before he's shot. He goes back, 1978, he has to go to Rome, he becomes the Pope. 1979, he goes back to Poland. He holds a rally, and in that rally, it is the largest single group of people who have ever gathered together in world history up to that point. They just flood to see him in Poland in 1979. And he gives this amazing speech. And in the speech, it's two things you have to know. Number one, he says, "We the Poles have been chosen for whatever reason to be the sacrificial victims of the 20th century. I don't know why, but we are." And he says to them, "That means, however, that you have to be the best Pole you can be. And therefore, you have to take for your exemplar this medieval saint," and I apologize if you never pronounce his name right, "Saint Stanislaus, who had been the king's best friend. But when the king had done something immoral, Stanislaus had challenged him, and the king had him beheaded." Now, just think about that. The Pope doesn't say, "Take up arms." He says, "That's your guy. That's who you have to be." And he tells them, an amazing moment. It sounds like a romantic dream. But the Pope tells them, "No matter what, never, ever take up the tools of the enemy to fight them. Because the moment you do that, you're no better than the enemy." And he ends this speech by saying, quoting the angel who appears to the women at the tomb, "Be not afraid." That's your mantra. That you just say that all the time. You're getting beaten. Your children are being beaten. You are having the Soviets take over. They're ruining your life. Be not afraid. This is it. Because for some reason, you've been chosen for this martyrdom. And that is an amazing moment, not only because the Pope is calling for this fight, that is a very romantic, peaceful fight, but the person who is most moved by this is a very devout Protestant raised in Disciples of Christ from Northern Illinois who's gone off to be a Hollywood actor, Ronald Reagan. Reagan is watching the speech in 1979, and he's with his best friend, a guy named Dick Allen, who's still alive. He's sitting with Dick Allen, and Dick Allen looks over to him, and Reagan has tears just streaming down his eyes. And Allen asks him, "Are you okay, Governor Reagan?" And Reagan says, "You understand, that man is the key to ending the Soviet Union, right there." And there's a formulation. So I'm going to jump back here for just a moment, because there's one other story I have to tell you before we get to Reagan. But Reagan had, we know from his diaries, since 1963, he had been writing in his own journals a form of what we might call fantasy Cold War, in which he had been listing, as early as 1963, before he even had any public office, he's a year away from being elected, no, I'm sorry, 3 years away from being elected governor of California, he has already outlined exactly how to defeat the Soviet Union. And he has a whole map, he has a plan. You do this, you do this, you do this. And his argument was, and he writes a book about this in 1968, but his argument is that, and it's all based on Hayek, that the only thing that matters is what's called the creative society. And Reagan says the creative society is that society in which you can never predict the future because it's creative. And all you have to do to make history work is you free people up to be people. That's all you do. You make someone totally free, and you see what they can do. That's the creative society. And so his argument, and he's the only one who believes this, nobody believes this, except for Reagan. And we don't often, now looking back in hindsight, we think, oh, he got lucky, it was the right time. It's not that. Reagan firmly believed that the Soviet Union had to die. And he didn't necessarily think we had to kill it. He believed, and one other person, Ludwig von Mises, believed this as well, but he believed that the Soviet Union had to fail because it was based on the false premise of human nature, and that is that humans could be controlled. That's it. It was that simple. Reagan said, because they believe in control, they will fall. They can't be self-sustaining. That was his argument. But he also knew there would have to be a catalyst. Well, the other person, going back to Carol Wojtyla for a moment, the other person who matters for us is, I'm sure some of you know the name, some of you probably don't, a guy by the name of Maximilian Kolbe, who's one of my great heroes. If you come into my office, some of you would have asked who my little monk action figure is, and that's Maximilian Kolbe. Maximilian Kolbe was a Polish priest who got arrested because he was extremely, extremely anti, very anti-Nazi, and he was arrested and he was put in Auschwitz in 1940, if I remember right, because he's there about 2 years. Now, Auschwitz, of course, is a major concentration camp, but this is before they had instituted the gas ovens. So it was a labor camp. I mean, it was brutal, it was horrible, and a lot of people died, but there weren't the mass executions yet. And it was mostly, because it's Polish, it was mostly made up of Jews, Catholics, and Lutherans, anyone who was a religious dissenter. And Kolbe was in there, he was one of them. And so this incredible moment, right at the end of July, I know he dies on August 13th, but he's in for 2 weeks. So whatever 2 weeks is, it's like July 29th. Don't quote me on that, but right at the end of July, there's a guy, and they're only known by names, by numbers. Right? In the gulag, you can't have a name. So his name was number 5659. And somebody had tried to escape, and the punishment of the Nazis was that any time someone tried to escape, they picked 10 numbers and they executed them. That was the punishment. And so one of the numbers that was picked was this guy, 5659, Polish man, atheist, didn't really believe anything. And he had a wife and kids who were also in the Holocaust camp with him. And so Kolbe, who had not been picked, raises his hand and he says, "I would like to take that man's place." And Nazi commandant's totally shocked. But nobody's ever done this. And in his kind of befuddlement, he says, "Okay, yeah, that's fine."
And so they take Colby, 16670. And what they do with these 10 men, and this is just, forgive me, this is just horrible, but they're a Nazi. They have a cell block called cell block number 13 that they seal, has no windows. It's a concrete bunker. It would last from about that wall to here, and it would be about from me to this front row. And that's it. But it's 3 feet high. That's it. No water, no food, no restroom, nothing. So they take 10 men, they strip them naked, they force them all into this concrete bunker, and they shut the door. And the goal, of course, is for them to resort to madness and cannibalism. That's what the Nazis want. And they, nothing happens. These guys are just in there. And they check on them at once. They're still alive. They're not doing well. The place reeks, of course, of feces and urine, but they're still alive. Commandant closes the door again. And finally, on August 13th, he says, look, these guys are the commandant. These guys are either dead or there's just no way they're alive. They open the door. Everybody's alive. Now, they're in horrible, horrible shape. And Colby is talking. He's been, according to the people who are in there, he's been talking for 2 weeks straight. He just hasn't stopped. He keeps preaching to them. He's been just quoting the gospel, preaching the gospel. And the commandant is furious. And he sends a guy in to inject all of them with carbolic acid, which was going to kill him immediately, of course. And the guy freaks out. He walks in. And here are all these just emaciated, the stench is just wretched. And he leaves. He can't handle it. And so to punish him, he gets duty of cleaning all these people out later. So another doctor goes in, kills them all, they're dead. But this guy who had been punished, he actually testified in court many years later to this, so under oath. He said, when I dragged Colby out, Colby was in a position, he was dead, totally dead. But he had his arm out where he had just accepted the injection. He just reached out, accepted the injection, put it in. And I'll quote from what this guy said in the testimony. No, I'm not going to find it right. Yes, no, here it is. He said, when I opened the iron door, Colby, of course, was no longer alive, but his face had an unusual radiance about it. His eyes were wide open, and they were clearly still focused on some definite point. But just think about that for a moment. Guy's dead, but he's focused on some definite point. His entire being was in a state of ecstasy. I will never forget that as long as I live. Now, that's incredible to think about that. And that's, John Paul says, these are your two heroes. They teach us how to fight these guys. They're it. So later, John Paul said, when he was giving his speech in particular about Colby, he said, what is Auschwitz? Auschwitz is the Golgotha of the modern world. It exists for one reason. It exists to destroy faith. Faith in God as well as faith in man. It is meant to trample radically not only on love, but on every side of human dignity and humanity. It is built on nothing but hatred and contempt for man, all in the name of an ideology. So really important. Okay, so third person, Ronald Reagan. And I will admit, I love the fact that we have an Eastern Orthodox, a Protestant, and a Catholic here. It's, I think, pretty cool. So if you noticed, I also gave them each offices, if you can read my writing. Right? So we've got a priest, a prophet, and a king. Ronald Reagan, as I said, is absolutely certain that the Soviets will fall. But it's only when he sees the Pope in 1979 that he becomes convinced that's the man. So you guys have to put this in context here. And again, please forgive me, I have to get a little personal about this. But I remember very well seventh grade, March of seventh grade, Principal Workman got on the loud system and he said, President Reagan has just been killed. And of course, Reagan had been shot. He had walked out of a hotel, and this young man from Utah, who was in love with the actress Jodie Foster, was trying to make his point, John Hinckley. He walks up to the president, and he opens fire on him right in front of one of the hotels in Washington. Kills one security guard, wounds permanently a secretary, and hits the car, and the bullet bounces off and goes right into Reagan. And it just barely misses his heart. And it's right between his lung and his heart. And everybody assumes he's dead. As my principal in junior high said, he's dead. So they rush into the hospital. And this is how funny Reagan is. I've never read the account of a funnier person. Reagan gains consciousness for a moment as he's in the hospital right after he's been shot. He knows what's happened. And he looks up at the doctors and he says, "Dear God, I hope you're not Democrats." And he goes back. That's how cool he was. So he does recover. And he actually, and this is, he is 70 right when he gets shot. He works out so much over the next 2 years that in 1983, one of those inserts in the newspaper, like Parade or whatever, USA Today, an insert shows a picture of him, buff. He has put 2 full inches on his chest after the shot. That's how much shape he got in. This is a 73-year-old guy, right? But here's what matters. He had had a terrible presidency up to that point. Nothing had gone right. But the moment he takes a bullet, nothing can go wrong. Everything goes right for him. And so he comes back, and I still carry my ticket with me. I love this. My oldest brother graduated from Notre Dame that year, so I'm in seventh grade. And on May 17th of 1981, Ronald Reagan gives a speech at Notre Dame, and it's one of the most important speeches that is given in American history. So everybody assumes that he's just going to kind of give this speech that's going to be kind of rah-rah Notre Dame. He's played a football player in a movie from Notre Dame, and so people thought this is what he's going to talk about. This is his first public appearance after the assassination attempt. And here he shows up, class of Notre Dame. 4 years earlier, Jimmy Carter had given the speech for that class. This is a tradition at Notre Dame. You always invite whoever's just been elected for that graduating class. And 4 years earlier, Jimmy Carter had said, "We have nothing to worry about the Soviets. They're really just people who are finding their way to democracy. We have an inordinate fear about them." Well, here comes Reagan. Reagan had not mentioned Russia once in his presidency. I'm not going to read the whole speech, but I was here. This is one of the greatest moments of my life to see this. And this is what he says. He says to my brother's graduating class, "We need you. We need your youth. We need your strength. We need your idealism, because there are so many things that are wrong, which we need to make right. Now, I know that this period of your life, at age 21 and 22, you have been taught to be critical, looking at every moray and custom. You've questioned every one of their values. Every generation does this. But may I suggest that you don't discard something simply because it was old. More importantly, don't allow the cynics in academia to persuade you that the best is over and that we're on a downhill path. Each generation sees farther than the generation before it, because it stands on the shoulders of that generation. And this, I promise you, the years ahead are great ones for this country. They are great for the cause of liberty and for the cause of civilization." And this is the most important 10 words of his presidency. Remember containment. He says, "The West will no longer contain communism. It will transcend it." In those 10 words, Reagan abolished foreign policy going back all the way to Truman. And of course, anyone who's listening knows exactly what he's saying. It's rollback time. And we're going to take you out. And we're going to take you out by any means necessary. So the West will no longer contain communism. It will transcend communism. It won't bother to denounce it. It will dismiss it as a bizarre chapter in human history. William Faulkner once said, that man will not only prevail because he is good, he will prevail because he knows the verities of the heart. Man alone is immortal because he has a soul, and he is capable of compassion and sacrifice. I could never say these words, compassion and sacrifice, without thinking about the man who exemplifies them best in the world, John Paul II. A man of total peace and goodness, an inspiration to the entire world, who would be struck down by a bullet from a man towards whom he would feel nothing but love. It was John Paul II who only a year ago warned us that ideologies speak in the name of justice while always justifying injustice, often through death, deprivation of liberty, or some fundamental right. So I end with this. You're graduating. Think about this. When the history of our time is written, who will dwell upon the hardships? History will ask, and our answer will determine the history of liberty for the next 1,000 years. Did America, born of hope, lose hope? Did America, forged by courage, find courage wanting? And did a generation that had been steeled by hard war and a harsh peace forsake honor at the greatest moment of this struggle for the human spirit? But that's just incredible. And a year later, he meets with the Pope, and we know that they laid out exactly how the Soviet Union would fall. And sure enough, November of 1989, it fell without a single shot being fired. And that's stunning. All right, I'll end you with that. I'll end that. Have a great weekend. I'll see you guys on Monday, 51. Right? Otherwise, I'll see you at the final. So,
be good.